Good evening. You're listening to the Hour of the Time. I'm William Cooper. Well, WBCQ is still having problems now. Their secondary transmitter has blown a blower, they say. And now they're transmitting on 300 watts. My question is, why does this always happen during my broadcast when I'm broadcasting something very important? Well, I don't know the answer to that. But it sure is suspicious. I'll tell you that right now. Well, since we have lost most of our shortwave audience, I guess I'm basically speaking to the people in the Round Valley of Arizona, which means I'm basically speaking to an awful lot of sheeple. Don't mean to hurt your feelings, but it's the truth, and you know it. And this is the third installment of Rules of Engagement, the 136-minute version, which is 2 hours and 16 minutes. And so since we do not have our international audience, and since this is the last installment of this series, which we will rerun, by the way, when the transmitter's back up to full power, we'll see what happens then. And if necessary, we'll rerun it and rerun it and rerun it until everybody hears it. But as soon as the tape is over tonight, we're going to go off the air. Probably will not be a full hour program. So, as usual, pay attention and make sure that you understand what you're hearing and how it affects your freedom and your future. If you don't understand any of that, then just turn off your radio and go to bed. Thank you.
there's nothing in the investigation of what was going on in the Washington Mansion, where they had a situation room which was supposedly constantly in touch with Waco. What were the communications that went on? What were the decisions made? And that we have never heard.
Dozens and dozens of rounds have been fired at FBI agents. The FBI, in an effort to demonstrate its extraordinary restraint, has not returned fire thus far.
Almost 2 miles above Mount Carmel, a surveillance plane was photographing events on the ground with a forward-looking infrared camera, commonly called by its acronym, FLIR. Edward Allard helped develop the FLIR. He's a former manager of the Defense Department's Night Vision Laboratory and holds several patents on FLIR and night vision technology. Allard explains what happens as a tank approaches the rear of Mount Carmel around 11:16 a.m. That's the side the news cameras couldn't see.
Thermal imagery is not the same as black and white imagery. Even though we're going to see images that look like it's black and white television cameras, it is not. This type of imagery is the same type of imagery that was used by our armed forces in Desert Storm. The bright spots in this particular film are spots that are hot. The gray area are warm, we'll say, and the black areas are cool. They're relatively cool. They're still pretty warm for a Texas midday, but they're a lot cooler than the rest of the surrounding area. If you look carefully, what you will see is the exhaust plume of the tank. You'll see the plume twice when the operator steps on the gas. There it is again. And now what you will see is a short burst there. That short burst, we feel, is a gunshot. The next view is a view in slow motion. As the vehicle approaches, we see the plume from the engine. And we have the gunshot. Now, freeze the tape, please. You can see now the outline of the tank. You can clearly see the outline of the tank. There's the blade. There's the blade in front of the tank. There's the opposite side of the tank. This hot area back here is the engine, the deck area. And it appears that the shot that we're looking at is coming off the rear deck area of the tank. This particular one, the burst lasted about 1 second. And we will see shots similar to this throughout the tape, and nothing else appears with the type of thermal signature that we get of gunshots.
Did the FBI fire one shot, even one shot at the division compound?
Not throughout the entire standoff.
What we're going to see here is what could be called an infantry tank maneuver. You notice the tank. This is the tank smashing into the building. And we'll also see gunfire, multiple gunfire, on the outside of the tank to the rear of the tank. Right now, we're seeing a close-up view of exactly the same thing. The important thing to notice is the gunfire, multiple rounds being fired from at least two different positions. And it's about 10 bursts in approximately 2 to 3 seconds. And according to our calculations, it indicates that both positions are firing automatic weapons. There is nothing in nature that would duplicate these type of thermal signatures, primarily because of the short duration of the bursts themselves. Nothing in nature could do that.
And I'll remind the American people one more time that during that entire time, those 6 hours, and indeed those 51 days, the FBI never fired one shot at the Davidians.
What we're going to see now is rapid fire in the courtyard right behind the dining room area. And you can see the fire going on, but it's difficult to see in real time. Now, the slow motion shows things much more clearly. Two positions. We look at the tape carefully. There are two positions, and apparently by the signature itself of the verse, apparently is going from this area here into the dining room area.
What Allard saw was verified in an independent FLIR analysis done by Infraspection Institute for CBS 60 Minutes. Quote, "It was obvious to me on several occasions that there was gunfire or automatic weapons discharge seemingly fired toward the building from the outer perimeter," end quote. A second letter from Infraspection Institute states the fear that kept 60 Minutes from informing the American people. Quote, "Due to the potentially sensitive nature of this material and the resulting negative repercussions to Infraspection, we are choosing to decline any further comments surrounding this taped incident and our subsequent professional opinion regarding its viewing," end quote. In addition to noticing the gunfire, Infraspection saw something else. Quote, "There were occasions on the video that seemed to appear as though people were entering, exiting, or being run over by an armored vehicle," end quote.
The whole idea here was not to hurt people, right?
That is correct.
Okay, I want to focus on that building right there and on that corner. You see it's now structurally sound. Could you go to the next photo? We're now looking kind of from the front corner. These are taken from the airplane. You will see that where he is pointing, that section of the building is gone. Indeed, a great portion of the building is gone.
There was a discussion that there may come a point in this where we would try to poke holes in the building.
I understood that.
Yes, sir.
Just I don't see the hole.
No, I understand that. Yes. And I do not believe that there were any bodies found in that area.
The closest bodies were found a little further in.
Yes.
Each one of those five bodies, it's reported, had extensive, according to the autopsy report, extensive body mutilation.
Davidian Stephen Henry had a gunshot wound to his chest. His leg was sheared off at the hip. James Riddle had been shot too, but a large circular portion of the right side of his chest had also been ripped out of his body. Riddle's red shirt was dangling from his wrist. His nearby coat had a red lining. This gunfire occurred at 11:24 a.m. About 10 minutes later, something got jammed near the tank's front wheel that caused the tread to come off. Something that was mostly red. The available evidence indicates that could be James Riddle's body. To attach the disabled tank to a retriever and tow it away, men had to expose themselves to the gunfire FBI officials said was coming from the Davidians.
This is one of these things, Mr. Chairman, that nags at you. Damage to the tanks, common sense tells me, would be reflected in the damage report. Almost 2 months ago, we requested it. Over 2 years have elapsed since this occurred. Surely the damage report had been compiled. I realize the wheels of bureaucracy turn awfully slowly in this town, but after 2 years...
I'll be glad to look into it and see what we can produce.
As the gassing continued, the women and children went to the safest place left inside Mount Carmel, the kitchen storage room, a first-floor steel-reinforced concrete room, a former vault at the bottom of the square wooden tower.
The women and children ended up going in there, and because they didn't have gas masks and stuff, they were covering themselves with wet blankets and wet towels and things like that.
We knew that protection was in there. We believe we finally were able to make entry into that compound and were able to insert gas inside that protective area.
He actually drove right through the middle of the building into the kitchen area, basically at point-blank range, fired gas into the concrete room where the women and children were, in a cul-de-sac like that where there was no ventilation. They must have been going through.
There was only one door.
Front entry. There's no windows, no back door or anything like that.
We put massive gas in there. Their gas mask by that time had to be failing.
They would be coughing, choking. They would probably be unconscious. Some of them would probably be dead. Some would be basically inert. They may still be alive. They may still be breathing, but they're not going to be doing anything.
In planning very large actions of this sort, like the going in at the building, you do a lot of planning, like if this happens, then this, we'll do this. And if this happens, we'll do this, correct?
Yes, sir.
Now, did you consider that fire might well occur in this instance? And if it does, we do this?
Yes, sir. We did.
By noon, Mount Carmel was a tinderbox. A heavy layer of dried CS dust coated everything inside. Large amounts of kerosene and Coleman fuel from containers crushed by armored vehicles saturated the floor. Vapors from methylene chloride, kerosene, and Coleman gas filled the air. Huge holes ripped open by the tanks let the 25-mile-per-hour Waco wind blow completely through Mount Carmel.
When the governmental agency made a decision to breach holes into the building, they set up a configuration of a pot-bellied stove. If you wanted to burn slow, you close off the vents. If you wanted to burn fast, you open it up. Well, they made a configuration in that building that was consistent to a pot-bellied stove. Any type of fire that would start, even if there was no CS gas, if there was no flammable liquids, there was nothing, just but ordinary combustible materials. Once you have a fire incipient in a building like that, it's going to grow to a fast, rapid propagation because of the venting.
At this front corner, a combat engineering vehicle has just made its last injection of CS. That small black dot is the nozzle tip, ice cold from the carbon dioxide propellant used to force the methylene chloride CS mixture into the building. Less than a minute later, the first of three separate fires that started in three separate locations within a three-minute period began here on the second floor, while the fresh mixture is at its most volatile as a fly mist.
Once ignited, both the CS and the methylene chloride will become involved in the fire and add to the fire. Those sources will tend to produce a fireball or a flash fire.
Two Branch Davidian survivors say they saw fireballs. Shortly after fresh CS was injected at this corner, the FLIR shows a second tank that's pulling away. As the corner comes into view, a fire is burning there. David Thibodeau said he was here and saw a fireball that ran the front length of Mount Carmel, possibly igniting another fire here in the kitchen dining room area, right next to the concrete room where the women and children had been gassed earlier. About a minute after the front fireball Thibodeau saw, another armored vehicle drives up to the rear of the crushed gymnasium and also pulls away. A few seconds later, survivor Derek Lovelock says a fireball raced from the rear of Mount Carmel to the front, igniting everything in its path.
At this point, the back of the gym was thoroughly destroyed, and it greatly disturbed me. At that point, I'd lost all hope. At 12 o'clock, someone yelled from the upstairs that there was a fire. The front, I could not get to the front because of what the tanks had come in, the stairwell that was closer to the front, so I went to the stairwell in the back. Because I'm thinking the kids, thinking Serenity C. Jones. I was thinking of Isaiah and Joseph, some of these kids that I've come to know and love. Get up there, and there was a catwalk that was leading over the rafters of the church area. I walked to the front. I got to a blanket. I opened the blanket up, and a wall of flame shoots down the hallway in front of my face down to the other end of the building. It was the loudest sound I've ever heard in my life. I'm a drummer. And it was incredibly loud. I could not hear anything else other than this flame.
Well, do you know personally how the fire started?
No.
The place is beginning to glow with black smoke, and me and Scott were stood there by the stairs, and there was this kind of ball of fire. There was the tremendous heat, which caused us to jump back out of the way. And it came from the gym area. Across this way.
It's believed the fireball Derek Lovelock said he saw started here with this flash.
That flash was so bright that the operator of the FLIR thought it was so significant that he decided to fix his cursor in that area to remind him or other people looking at the tape that there was a very significant flash in the window. When we see it in slow motion and we see the flash, it appears to be a single flash, but it is not a single flash. It's actually two flashes. We get a primary flash and a secondary flash, and both of these flashes last about 1/2 second each. And they're most likely detonations inside the building itself.
Now, if some of you just saw this flash here, that is a momentary event. In my opinion, that's a reflection due to sunlight reflecting off some object in that debris.
Sunlight reflections would show up as a flash on regular film which records light. But reflections don't generate enough heat, say specialists like Allard, to create a flash on infrared. Introspection analysts noticed the same flash. Quote, a portion of the video showed a flash or pyrotechnic explosion in one portion of one of the buildings, end quote.
The FBI made it clear from the beginning it used nothing that could have started a fire.
Non-pyrotechnic delivery systems were utilized to insert CS gas.
Pyrotechnic devices actually burn, and as they do, tear gas is dispersed.
This pyrotechnic projectile is one of two found in the rubble of Mount Carmel. It's a 40-millimeter military device that's fired from a handheld grenade launcher. This one was found here, near the corner of Mount Carmel where the first fire started. The other was found here, in the kitchen dining room area. Seconds after the two gymnasium flashes, still more automatic gunfire can be seen coming from the field to the left of the demolition tank.
We counted the number of gun flashes, and in this particular case, we got 6 flashes in 1 second, which indicates it's a rapid-fire weapon of some kind. And we also can see from the tapes that the fire is going in this direction towards the gymnasium where we saw the flash in the window.
When the fire did start and the fire trucks did arrive, I didn't let them in. I held them at the checkpoint because I didn't want the firemen to drive into gunfire. I just wasn't going to permit it. And it's a terrible thing, a very terrible decision to have to make. But I didn't hesitate. It took me that 2 seconds to make it. But we held the fire trucks. So that was our fire plan.
Most of the remaining Davidians were concentrated here in the kitchen dining room area. It was their only way out except for one thing. Two men outside were firing machine guns at them.
In the 51 days the FBI was involved, they did not fire a single shot. That would mean quite certainly that 27 of the people who died in the compound, I think the autopsy report showed 27, I may be off by one or two, but who died of bullet wounds, those were self-inflicted or inflicted by other members within the compound.
These are embers that are flying off the building, but you can see up in here that this is rapid gunfire. When we analyzed the tape, we found out that there's two people there in this area here. And they're firing for about 30 seconds in this area right here where we have the burning dining room area. And it's almost continuous gunfire. And towards the end of this particular section, we find out that the people doing the shooting are actually retreating away from the fire and shooting as they're retreating.
The machine gunning of the Davidians trapped in the burning kitchen dining room was not only visible to congressional investigators, it was even visible to home viewers. So is the gunfire behind the tank smashing into the rear of the gymnasium. Neither was mentioned despite the fact the FLIR tape shown to the Joint Committee had far better clarity than the copy used in this film.
see the flames real good from here.
There came a point in my rolling on the floor and trying to protect myself from the heat and being in the pitch black, not able to see, that the voices of those behind me screaming kind of got through to me. I recognized who they were. I could identify the voices. They kind of galvanized me to just leap to my feet and jump or dive headfirst in the general direction of where I figured the hole was. When I stood up, the skin was rolling off my hands. My coat was all melted on my back and smoking. I looked back over my shoulder, and the hole had just come out with a mass of flames. And the first thought that came to me was, I'm the only one.
I was just going on and on. We realized nobody came out, thinking maybe my husband didn't get out, but my children got out. Horrible, horrible way to die. I try not to think about it because I keep thinking at some point they felt all that heat. I kept thinking the people in the square, they were the ones who maybe they probably cooked to death. I think it was to be this tragedy to show what kind of people we have as a government.
As soon as the Branch Davidian Star David flag had fluttered to the ground, they ran the ATF flag up on that flagpole as a symbol of a military conquest, because the whole world saw this as a symbol that the battle was over.
I love this country. I love the flag. I love saying the Pledge of Allegiance. I still cry at the national anthem. I hope not only law enforcement, but I hope everyone does that. The FBI is not, as we've been labeled for the past 2 years, anti-religious rights or anti-personal rights. We have plenty of freedoms in this country, which I love. We have the freedom to stockpile weapons. I know I'm a Christian. I like practicing my Christian beliefs. I know I'm going to heaven when I die with my kids. I teach in charge of the nursery, used to do Sunday school, youth group leader. If someone tries to stop me from doing that, obviously I'm going to be upset. But that does not give me the right to go kill someone, go to my house, using my children as shields, and say, I'm not coming out. I've broken the law. I'm not coming out until God tells me to. That is wrong. The hearings have been on for 9 days or so. And I'm going to say this as nicely as I can, because a couple people have said, what can we learn from this? In 9 days, I can't learn to be a legislator. In 9 days, y'all can't learn to be law enforcement officers. Byron, Floyd Clark, Jeff Jamar, Dick Rogers, like them or not, or like what we do for a living or not, they've been law enforcement officers, some of them, longer than I've been alive. And with that comes a lot of experience. What I'm saying is you have to trust the people in charge at the time. I'm low on the food chain, so I'm standing by what they did, because I do what I'm told as long as it's legal and moral.
My God. Torturing babies and saying it's part of their job and saying it's okay because their parents were bad. Our whole society is structured around the notion that if parents are bad, we protect the children even against the parents. In this case, the FBI and the government took the position, why, not only do we not protect the children, we use them as an instrument to try to get their parents to do something. We'll torture them so their parents will do right. Oh, my God, where did they think that up?
I hope you heard the part, ladies and gentlemen, when the agent was testifying. I hope you were listening very carefully. There was a Freudian slip there. He meant to say that they've been law enforcement officers longer than I've been alive. But what he said is they've been law enforcement officers longer than I've been a liar. Now that's amazing.
Their instincts, the motherly instincts would take place, and that they would want their children out of that environment. It appears they don't care that much about their children, which is unfortunate.
The backward-bowed corpse of this 8-year-old girl shows what cyanide does to the human body. It makes the muscles contract so violently that they can actually break bones.
If one reviews the various use of cyanide as a method of putting prisoners to death, you note that these people are strapped in their chairs very heavily, and that's not to prevent them from escaping the gas. Has to prevent the individuals watching the execution observing the effects the cyanide has on the muscles of the individual.
As part of the evidence response team, I was one of the primary photographers that had to photograph the evidence before it was recovered, and as it was being recovered and placed into the appropriate bags. I photographed the process, David Koresh's living quarters, and I also photographed all of the bodies from what is termed the bunker. Having been in a position to walk, touch, feel, hold, photograph, observe a great majority of the bodies in Waco, I'm left with an overall disturbing and a haunting opinion that many of the people in the residence were homicide victims.
One of the FBI officials told Dr. Kirwani that they did not want us there because they wanted to do it themselves.
The FBI lab was extremely in a hurry to get the evidence from us, and it took us several weeks to go through literally thousands of rounds. All the bullets, bullet cartridges, fragments of grenades, they were all turned over to the FBI lab.
No independent examination of any of that evidence has been allowed, including the illegal firearms the FBI says were found in the rubble.
Is that a weapon illegal that you found at the compound?
It's an AK-47 type rifle that has been converted to permissible automatic
making
firearms.
It illegal.
Yes, sir.
Thank you.
Now that's the part, ladies and gentlemen, that I was speaking of last night. You notice he was asked if that was a fully automatic weapon that was found, an illegal weapon that was found in the compound. And the agent didn't answer that question. He said this is a fully automatic AK-47. And the congressman said, is that illegal? And he said, yes, it's illegal. But it was not found in the compound. You see, you can't see the videotape. I'm watching it on the monitor here. It's a brand new AK-47, has never been fired, doesn't have a scratch on it, has never been in a fire, is not burned, not scorched, not bent, not melted, none of the wood of the stock is burnt or scorched or even charred. He just flat, basically, bare-ass, bull-face lied. And the American people bought it because, you know, they're too stupid to understand that he didn't answer the question. He just said, this is a fully automatic AK-47, the congressman asked. Is that illegal? And he said, yes, it's illegal. Well, it's not illegal if you, at that time, if you paid the $200 tax. The only thing that would make it legal or illegal is whether or not you paid $200 in tax to be able to own and possess it. You see, anybody in this country can own a fully automatic weapon. All you have to do is pay the tax. Now, since then, they've jacked the tax up to around $1,600. If you got $1,600, you can possess and own and keep in your home any fully automatic weapon that you want. You dummies. You make me sick. You really do.
I was panning the whole site, and one of the rangers came up behind me while I was still taping and hit me on the shoulder and said, "You can't be doing that." And so I said, "Okay, that's fine, no problem." And then he asked for the tape. And I said, "Well, I'm shooting for Dr. Kirwani, and I'm not going to give you the tape until he says it's okay." Finally, we found Dr. Kirwani, talked to him, and he agreed that it was okay for me to give them the tape, so I did. They promised us that all they wanted to do was review it, and they would give it back to us the next day. And they didn't.
They told us that they had misplaced it. At one time, they told us that I have it in my briefcase and I'll give it to you. In fact, we said that they're going to delay giving the reports until you give a tape back. And of course, they said, "Sure, we'll give you a tape back next time we come to your office." We, in fact, suggested we would go to Waco and collect the tape from them. And they said, "No, it's San Antonio office." And at a certain point along this discussion, they finally said, "The tape is lost. We can't give it to you."
At this point, is there any doubt in your mind or the Justice Department's mind that the fire was set by the cult members?
I have absolutely no doubt at all that the cult members set it based on all the information that has been furnished to me.
The survivors that came out, their clothes smelled of accelerants. They smelled diesel fuel, they smelled of lantern fuel, they smelled of lighter fluid, and the laboratory later came back and confirmed that they had done it.
I would like to know why key information as to how some of this contamination occurred was omitted from the reports, specifically those survivors who exited the south side of the building. They had to walk to an area that was contaminated by fuel from large tanks spilled by the government tank operations. The thing that really concerns me is why the building was so totally destroyed afterwards, after the fire was out. There was no firefighting whatsoever attempted, and then the crime scene, and it was a crime scene, was totally, absolutely destroyed. I've seen this happen before.
Did you see the FBI changing the crime scene in any way?
Yes, sir. As I'd said earlier and didn't get to finish the answer, they were moving the vehicles, which destroyed valuable trajectory evidence. And in the end, it turned out it didn't matter because the...
But it didn't seem to be standard operating procedure. You don't consider that standard operating procedure, do you?
Certainly not in any crime scene I've ever been on, no.
We were commissioned early on in this as Deputy United States Marshals to carry a special commission so that we could prosecute federally anyone that lied to us. And we feel real comfortable, and Captain Burns does, that we were lied to.
That's Texas,
let me be clear.
Texas Rangers.
This investigation has not uncovered any evidence of political corruption or influences. We have not found any of that. There was no conspiracy to kill Branch Davidians. The record of the Waco incident documents mistakes. What the record from Waco does not evidence, however, is any improper motive or intent on the part of law enforcement.
Just so you'll know, ladies and gentlemen, that was Congressman Orrin Hatch from Utah, lying through his teeth. Lying through his teeth. Of all the evidence presented to the Congress during that investigation, pointed to the fact that everything that happened was illegal, unlawful, that Branch Davidians were murdered, that it was intentional, and Orrin Hatch lied, and continues to lie.
Rash and the Davidians set fire to themselves and committed suicide. The government did not do that.
And that's Congressman Joseph Biden lying through his teeth. Lying through his teeth. Ignored the testimony, all the testimony that was presented, the evidence that was presented, the FLIR tapes that were presented. Lied. It's a lie. Well, oh my goodness. But aren't all politicians liars? Well, of course. So we expect it. So it's really not so bad after all, is it? After all, he's just a politician. Right? Sheeple?
Assertion to me that the media and that the government has made a kind of blanket declaration that the Branch Davidians committed, quote, mass suicide, to equate it to a Jonestown, Guyana suicide, is the most irresponsible statement that can be attributed to anything having to do with the Waco incident. And I find that very offending to me and offensive to the memory of the Davidians and everyone else involved in this tragedy to wrap it up in a nice, clean, well, it was just a mass suicide in the story, because it was far from it. What the people believed that would happen is that God was going to judge either the world or them. If it judged the world, they would survive. If it judged them, they would promptly be in heaven. As one of them afterwards said, Livingstone Fagan, who lost a wife in the fire and his mother in the fire, he said, those of our people who died are highly honored in heaven, and so we should not worry about them. The thought was that the army of Babylon would kill them, as perhaps it ultimately did.
The way things are supposed to happen in this country is when someone's suspected of a crime, even if it's child abuse, even if it's capital murder, we give them a trial. A jury finds them guilty beyond a reasonable doubt before they go to sentencing. Then a jury or a judge sentences them, and an appeals court makes sure the trial was conducted with due process. And then and only then do we kill them. We don't kill them first, like happened in Waco on April the 19th.
And that's it, ladies and gentlemen. And now I want to tell you something that I have recently discovered within the last 3 or 4 weeks. It breaks my heart to tell you this because the person that I'm going to tell you about, I consider to be a friend, believed in him, that he was a patriot, a friend, and he assured me that he was a patriot and a friend, and that anything that passed from me to him would be kept secret between he and I forever. He brought his car up here to park in front of our house to make it look like there were more people here. He brought us some window armor to hang in front of the windows in case we were attacked, so that it would stop the bullets. And he brought me a bulletproof vest to wear if I needed it. But we have recently discovered that Glenn Jacobs, the editor and publisher of the Round Valley paper, is the one who originally identified our home to agents of the Internal Revenue Service and the Federal Bureau of Investigation. We've also recently discovered that Glenn Jacobs has been reporting our activities to the Eager Police Department and to the Federal Bureau of Investigation for the entire time that this has been going on. Glenn masquerades as a patriot, publishing a patriot newspaper. But in fact, Glenn Jacobs is an informant for the local Eager and Springerville Police Department and for the Federal Bureau of Investigation, and, as it turns out, for the Internal Revenue Service. Patriots are everywhere. Those of you who think that you might want to be informants against patriots had better understand that patriots are everywhere. There are patriots in the FBI. There are patriots in the Eager Police Department. There are patriots in the Springerville Police Department. There are patriots in the Department of Public Safety, DPS, Highway Patrol. There are patriots in the military. There are patriots in Washington, D.C. There are even patriots in the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms. You cannot inform on patriots and get away with it. You will be discovered. When you are discovered, the fact that you are an informant will be made public. Now, Glenn, if you're listening, you have nothing to worry about for me. I'm not a vindictive person. I don't go around seeking revenge. God will deal with you. You're not a patriot. You're a traitor. A despicable rat. And I would urge anybody listening, don't hurt Glenn. Let God deal with him, because God will deal with him. He intentionally deceived us, lied to us, led us on, pretended that he was a friend, and all the while, he was an informant. And the same patriots within the law enforcement community have told me that Glenn Jacobs has been an informant for years, informing upon his neighbors and the citizens who live in the Round Valley. If you're listening, Glenn, you'd better say your prayers tonight. Don't ever make the mistake of coming back up here to pretend that you're some kind of a friend of patriots or of this family. For in your activities, you endangered the lives of my wife and my children. You endangered the lives of my wife and my children. And for that, I will never forgive you as long as I live. You can sleep well. I will never hurt you. I believe in God and I trust in God. Vengeance is mine, saith the Lord. Fear God, Glenn. Fear God. Good night, ladies and gentlemen, and God bless you all. And may God bless you, Annie, Pooh, and Allison. I love you. All my heart and soul. You're listening to 101.1 FM Eager. We now return you to All Oldies Most of the Time.